Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
Hi, I'm Scott Hahn, and I'd like to invite you personally to join me and Breadbox Media on August 24th in New Oxford, Pennsylvania, for a day of spiritual renewal. I'll be presenting three talks, one on St. Joseph, one on the sacrament of matrimony, and another one on the Holy Eucharist. Learn more and register at breadboxmedia.com/PA conference. I hope to see you there.
Introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love.
Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and it's open forum today. If you have a question about the Catholic faith, 888-318-7884 is the number to call, whether you're Catholic or not. And whether your question is of a more religious or philosophical nature or not, that is also welcome. Everybody's welcome to call if you have a question about faith, about morals, about Catholic teaching, about the traditions of the church, the Bible. 888-318-7884. The number. Our guest this hour is Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers and the author of Look at This, Jimmy.
Yeah.
The Bible is a Catholic Book.
Uh-huh. New book.
It's. I don't know how I got a copy of it. Somebody, I guess it was Carrie.
I didn't even have one.
They didn't get, I guess.
They haven't given the author one. What's up with that?
Well, maybe because they knew that we were going to be in front of these cameras and they wanted me to like hold it up like that.
Probably why.
So yeah. Carrie put it on the desk here. Mm-hmm. But congratulations on the completion of the book. The Bible is a Catholic Book.
Thank you.
I've been reading in it today.
Uh-huh.
I've not completed it yet.
Uh-huh. Well, I would be surprised if you
That'd
had
be pretty
completed
good, huh?
it. Yeah.
Yeah. It brings up a question for me, though.
Uh-huh.
I just got to this part, and I have not finished reading it. I shouldn't say it never occurred to me, but I never investigated with any closeness this idea of chapters and verses in the Bible.
Oh yeah,
where did that come from? It didn't originally have Luke didn't write. This is chapter 1, verse 1.
Right.
Chapter 1, verse 2.
Yeah. Well, it came in stages, and I talk about the stages in a kind of simplified way. There were different proposals at different times in history, but the chapter system was established basically by the 1200s or so by mm-hmm. an English archbishop, and then the verses came in later in the 1500s, at least the systems that ended up sticking.
And when scholars look at it now, do they go, they probably got that one wrong. Maybe should have all...
Oh, yeah. Like, yeah, yeah. Regular thing you'll read in commentaries is... commentators will point out that there is this division is artificial and we should really read what we're reading now in light of what is just before it or just after it, and that connection gets obscured by the chapter and verse division. On the other hand, they are extremely useful, which is why they're there in the first place. It makes it possible to say exactly where someone needs to go to look something up.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to what you find ancient authors saying, which is stuff like, as Isaiah says somewhere.
Yeah.
Well, great. Isaiah is the longest prophetic book of the Old Testament. Can you narrow
it
down a
little
bit?
Through the whole entire thing. Or actually, it was a scroll, so you'd have to...
Yeah, roll through it.
Oh, yeah. It does make life much easier. And it's one way for Protestants to show they're better than Catholics, too. Because they know them. No, that's not true.
That's not true.
All right. 888-318-7884 is the number. I should tell you that the Bible is a Catholic Book. It's not ready to be sent to you yet, but they are taking pre-orders. If you order it now, it will be to you within mere weeks from today. And I think you'll be very happy that you did. You can look over at shop.catholic.com for that. Again, our number, 888-31-TRUTH. Lots of calls already for you, Jimmy. Let us start with Ryan in Washington, watching on YouTube Live. Ryan, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi, can you guys hear me?
Yes, Ryan.
Excellent. Okay, so I'm taking an environmental science class, and also according to the subject material that's being given, it says in order to create a more sustainable future, we have to, and concerning climate change as well as our conserving our resources, they say we have to educate women and use birth control to decrease the human population so it can stabilize. And that's the agenda that's being used by these scientists. So my question is, what's the Catholic response to this?
Well, the question of what an appropriate level of population is something that people can have different opinions on. It's going to depend on a variety of factors, and not all of those factors that people in the secular world might take into account are ones that a person coming from a Christian point of view would want to take into account. For example, you could have a kind of utopian ideal that if we can't all live like people in Star Trek,
yeah,
you know, then we should have fewer people so we can jack up everybody's individual wealth level to where it's all amazing and utopian all the time. On the other hand, if you view people as being a good thing, then you could say, you know, we could, even if it means a little less individual wealth, having more people is a good thing.
Yeah.
And it gives more people a chance to live and enjoy God's creation. And so there will be some differences of factors there. In terms of this, I mean, I can't say this is the Catholic response, but a number of things occur to me right off the bat. The first one is this kind of Malthusian reasoning that we've got to reduce the number of people because we're going to run out of resources and it's going to harm the climate and things like that is problematic. We've been hearing this kind of scaremongering for a long time. And even, I mean, going back to Thomas Malthus himself.
Yeah.
And what we've discovered over the course of time is this isn't a zero-sum game. We've improved technologically as we have progressed through time. And so the Earth is able to carry a lot more people than it would have been with, say, 17th century technology. With 21st century technology, it can carry more people just fine. And with 22nd or 23rd century technology, it can carry even more people than it can with present technology. So we shouldn't assume that more people is going to mean more problems, because what has happened historically is as you add more people, they get inventive and they figure out better solutions to things that actually can improve the situation for everybody. Virtually everybody on Earth today has a vastly superior standard of living compared to the past, unless you're in a war-torn, failed state type region. And even those are much smaller than they used to be. The second thing that occurs to me is the idea that we have to do particular things in order to stabilize the Earth's population. The Earth's population is already stabilizing without any draconian programs. The rate of expansion, I mean, I remember back in the 1970s when I was growing up, there was all these, if present trends continue, the world's going to have this unsustainable number of people by so-and-so, and the curve just goes up more and more sharply, and there's going to be starvation within a decade.
Or unless you eat Soylent Green.
Well,
there was all these scary movies.
Yeah,
about
there were.
The world is going to be vastly overpopulated. We'll
right.
have to start eating each other.
And that none of those things have happened. And current United Nations estimates show a stabilization of the world's population later on in this century. So that's already happening. Also, the idea that even if we did need to take active measures to plan families and stabilize the world's population, as if technology weren't getting better and as if it weren't already stabilizing, that doesn't mean you need to use artificial contraception to do it. You need to work with God's plan, and there are perfect ways of working with God's plan that are not going to result in runaway population. The question isn't as much, should we use reason to determine what's a reasonable number of children? The question is, once we've identified what's a reasonable number of children, what means do we use to achieve that goal? And it doesn't automatically, even the existence of a need to say we don't want more children than this because it would cause problems to have more right now, that doesn't mean that it justifies any and all means of getting to that goal. I mean, suppose you've already had 10 kids, you decide you can't take care of that many, you can't just go shoot the excess kids. You know, that's not an appropriate means of limiting your family size. And the same thing is true on a national level or even a global level. You couldn't use genocide, for example, as a way of controlling global population. And in the same way, you need to work with God's plan for human reproduction instead of trying to thwart it as a way of achieving whatever reasonable goals there may be.
Thanks, Ryan. Thanks very, very much. Remember, Thanos is the villain of the piece. He's the one that wants to control population.
Oh, snap.
I know you get the reference, Jimmy. It's back to school time. We still have that for parents heading with their kids heading back to school. We have a free ebook we'd like to give you. You just go to shop.catholic.com. You can get all kinds of back to school stuff, and you can get the Catholic Answers Back to School Primer for Parents for free. So a lot of stuff on sale during this back to school time. Visit shop.catholic.com, and while you're there, click on that banner and get your free copy of the ebook, The Catholic Answers Back to School Primer for Parents.
We're here for you. Call now. Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live is proudly supported by CatholicChemistry.com, a new dating site for Catholics who want to do dating right and believe relationships start with Catholic chemistry. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicChemistry.com for their generous support on the web at CatholicChemistry.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Magnificat. Published monthly, Magnificat features daily Mass, prayers, articles, and meditations in step with the liturgical rhythm of the Church. On the web at Magnificat.com.
The leading Catholic voices are on EWTN Radio.
Our mission is to transform the world one woman at a time through a spiritual program of formation that helps them to see who they are as daughters of the Most High God and to enjoy the gift that God has given to them by virtue of their femininity.
Women of Grace with Jeanette Bankovic-Williams. Tomorrow morning, 11 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Open Forum. Jimmy Akin here with us. 888-318-7884. The number 888-31-TRUTH. We go now to Mike in Youngstown, Ohio, listening on 89.5 FM Living Bread Radio. Mike, your question for Jimmy.
Hi. I just had a really quick question for you guys. I just got out of adoration about 20 minutes ago, and this crossed my mind. What does canon law or any other teaching authority within the Church say, if anything, about who should be handling the Eucharist during adoration?
Okay, so by adoration, what you're actually referring to is Eucharistic exposition, correct? Where you have the Eucharist exposed in a monstrance?
Yes.
You're not talking about just going and adoring Jesus reposed in a tabernacle? Because that also would be adoration.
The monstrance.
Yeah. So the ordinary minister for that is a priest or deacon, but the church's regulations don't restrict it to priests and deacons. The document Holy Communion and Worship of the Eucharist outside of Mass, if you look in paragraph 91 of that document, which governs this, it says, in the absence of a priest or deacon, or if they are lawfully impeded, the following persons may publicly expose and later repose the Holy Eucharist for the adoration of the faithful. A, an acolyte or an extraordinary minister of Holy Communion. B, a member of a religious community or of a lay association of men or women which is devoted to Eucharistic adoration upon appointment by the local ordinary. So there are a variety of lay people who can expose and repose the Eucharist for the adoration of the faithful, provided there isn't a priest or deacon available. And there is one further restriction, which is that laity are not allowed to give benediction with the Eucharist. So they can expose and repose it, but they cannot give benediction with it.
Okay.
Okay, yeah, that helps me out a lot. Thank you very much.
Well, okay. Thank you, Mike. Let's go to Tyler in Colorado, listening on 1060 AM. Tyler, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hey, so I have a relative who is dealing with a gender dysphoria. Mm-hmm. He does not want to be called a she, but has tendencies to want to put his hair up, wear a dress, that kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
He recognizes that this is not within the Catholic Church teachings, or is something he can exercise. And so I'm looking for resources for him that I can point him to,
okay,
for things to help him bear that cross.
Okay. A couple of things occur to me. One of them is my colleague Trent Horn has a book called Made This Way that he wrote with Layla Miller.
Yeah.
And that could be a possible resource. Even more than that, though, there's a group called Courage, which is designed to help people with same-sex attraction. And I would suggest seeing if there's a local chapter of Courage he might be able to be involved with, or even more distantly to be involved with Courage.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tyler. Thanks very much. It is open forum today. If you have a question about the Catholic faith, Catholic belief, Catholic people, you've got a question about the Bible, about the Christian faith more generally, or you got a religious or moral question you'd like to pose, Jimmy Akin here with us both hours, 888-318-7884, the number. Let's go to Daniel in Fort Worth, Texas now, watching on YouTube Live. Hi, Daniel in Fort Worth, Texas. You got a question for Jimmy?
Hey, guys. I actually have a question about the difference. Okay, so this is my question. How can we know with absolute certainty outside of the Bible that God is a personal God and that he actually cares of us? So I agree with Aquinas' points about God, that he's spaceless, timeless, immaterial, infinite, all-powerful. But it doesn't really prove that God is a personal God. It could be any God, right? So how can we get from a deistic understanding of God to a personal theistic God without having to use the Bible necessarily, but from our own reason?
Okay. Well, there are a variety of arguments that have been proposed in this regard. One of them deals with, I can think of a number off the top of my head, but basically there are, I need to back up, because the term deism refers to the idea that God exists, that there is a single God, and that he started the universe but doesn't really interact with it anymore. And deism does not imply that God is not personal. A deistic God can be a personal God, meaning a God who is a person,
mm-hmm,
or even more than one person. Theism, by contrast, is the belief that God not only exists and is personal, but also interacts with the world,
okay,
in various ways. Now, I want to be clear on your question, Daniel. Are you wanting to prove that God has personal attributes like a mind, an intellect, and a will? Or are you wanting to show that God cares about us? Or are you wanting to show that God interacts with us?
Basically the last two, that he cares about us and interacts with us.
Okay. Well, if you understand God to be an omniperfect being, a being that has all possible perfections, then one of those perfections is going to be love. And that's going to entail right there, God loves his creations, including us. And so, that's one of the most common understandings of what God is an all-perfect being. And I think it's possible to take the concept of an all-perfect being and sort of not exactly, but along the lines of Anselm's ontological argument, I think it's possible to argue that an omniperfect being must exist. Just the concept requires it. There's no way for that not to exist. And if that's the case, then this omniperfect being is going to have the virtue of love and is going to love us. It may not be love exactly as we understand it here, because we have a limited shadow of what ultimate love is, but it's going to be real. In terms of interacting with us, it can't be proven simply philosophically that that God must interact with us beyond creating and us and sustaining us in existence. There's no philosophical proof that miracles must happen, because they depend for their occurrence on the voluntary decisions of God. And God could choose to operate in nature in such a regular way that we can't look for any blips that stand out as miracles. Because if he just maintains the laws of nature going along doing their thing, then there are no, and if there are no disruptions to those observable patterns, then there's nothing to say that he's directly involving himself, as opposed to just having set up the system and allowing it to run its course. So we can, though, look beyond the Bible to find evidence of miracles, and there are. It's kind of surprising to some folks, but there are there's considerable evidence for miracles occurring today. There was a multi-volume set by, I want to say, I don't think it's Craig Evans. It may be, but I'll have, over the course of the break, I'll dig up the name of the author and be able to recommend a set on modern that deals with modern miracles by the time we're done with the break, if not sooner.
Okay, Dan.
Thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, of course.
Well, let's go to Trevor in Northern Alberta.
Oh. It's Miracles by Craig Keener, K-E-E-N-E-R.
You still with us, Daniel? Did you get that?
Yeah, you said Greg Keener?
Craig with a C.
Oh, okay. Craig Keener. Okay.
All righty. Now let's go to Trevor in Northern Alberta, Canada, watching on Facebook Live. Trevor, your question for Jimmy Akin.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. My question is regarding when people are praying, I hear of different people using holy oils, incense, blessed candles and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I also heard of people using excise salt. When and how are these things to be used, and can lay people use them?
So these are what we refer to as sacramentals, and there are regulations dealing with the way sacramentals are used. There aren't a lot of really specific ones. I mean, if you want to light a candle as a symbol of praying to God, just go ahead and light a candle. You want to have the candle blessed by a priest first, go ahead and do that. If you want to bless yourself using holy water, you can do that. If some people will drink holy water, I've known people who have like drunk Lord's water if they have an internal illness.
Oh yeah,
and they want to ask God to heal them of that. I've known that to happen. There aren't a lot of regulations regarding this, as long as people aren't being superstitious about it, thinking that these things have some kind of innate power that will necessarily bring about the desired effect. We use these things as a way of asking God to help us in various ways, but we recognize that whether or not that actually occurs is ultimately up to God, and he'll make the decision based on what's best for us. In regard to, there are a few regulations. A number of years ago, the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith and some other groups at Rome came out with a document that restricted the use of holy oils by the laity, in particular in healing ceremonies, because they didn't want confusion between that and the sacrament of anointing of the sick. So we shouldn't be simulating the sacraments with the use of these sacramentals. But as long as we recognize the nature of the sacramentals, there aren't a lot of detailed regulations other than just recognize this for what it is and don't get superstitious about it.
Perfect. Knocked it out of the park as usual, Jimmy. Thank you very much.
Out of the park? Jimmy, it's a sports reference?
I understand that much.
Okay. Just wanted to make sure. Let's go to Jennifer in Illinois, listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Jennifer, your question for Jimmy.
Good evening.
Good evening, Jennifer.
I just, first of all, have to say thank you for taking my call and let you know how much you have changed my life. Jimmy and Cy, I mean, so much of what you guys do is just changing lives. My question to you is, I have a son who has mental illness and addictions, and I truly, truly feel he is being pulled by the devil on a daily basis. He is actually in the hospital right now. My question is there something like tangible, physical, that I could do to his apartment to maybe bless it, call my priest maybe to, I know you were just talking about oils and things like that, or holy water, to maybe bless his apartment before he comes home, just something like that. So that's just kind of what I'm getting.
Yeah, no, I mean, you could always take holy water yourself and bless it. You could ask a priest to come over and bless his apartment. There are deliverance prayers that, in fact, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops had recently published a little booklet of church-approved prayers of this sort, and you could find that on their website. You could say prayers of that nature. I would suggest contacting a priest and having the priest come over and bless the apartment if you think that would be helpful. I also would counsel you to be careful in attributing these things that are happening to the devil, because we're told that the sources of problems in the world are the world, the flesh, and the devil. The devil's just one of those things. So don't assume that mental illness and addictions are all the devil in any direct way. But you can certainly have the apartment blessed and say prayers.
God bless you, Jennifer, and your son. Thanks for the call. Right back with more Open Forum.
In his new audio presentation, The Very First Fathers, apologist Jimmy Akin takes you on a tour of the earliest Christian writings outside the New Testament. From the most famous figures and most notable works to those lesser known but no less important, this pivotal time in the development of the early church is revealed in fascinating detail. Jimmy shows how, even in the first century after the resurrection, it was necessary to defend and explain truths that are still under attack today, such as the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist and the perpetual virginity of Mary. The Very First Fathers is a compelling look at the dawn of the Christian age and edifying listening for anyone who wants to understand and defend the full truth of Catholicism. Order your copy of The Very First Fathers today by calling 1-888-291-8000, logging on to the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Looking for an on-fire Catholic speaker for your event? Catholic Answers speakers will inform and inspire your audience to grow in their Catholic faith. For more information on booking a Catholic Answers speaker, visit CatholicAnswersSpeakers.com today.
Love and beauty. As a little girl, Dawn Eden Goldstein knew that she wanted those things, that in them somehow she would find God. Over the years as a rock journalist, she moved among some of popular music's best-known artists, straining to capture that transcendent love and beauty in every note and lyric. In Sunday Will Never Be the Same, Dawn recounts her spiritual journey in beautifully wrought detail, mixing powerful accounts of trauma, healing, and epiphany with funny anecdotes from inside the music scene. It is the rare conversion story that delights as it inspires, amuses as it edifies, and ultimately lays before the reader a lived testimony to the transforming grace of Christ. Order your copy of Sunday Will Never Be the Same by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Hi, this is Dr. David Andrews. Do you have questions about the Catholic faith? Get the answers on Call to Communion tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio. Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Open forum. I want to say hello to Joseph in Da Nang, Vietnam. He just checked in on Facebook. We don't usually get people from Vietnam, so I thought I'd say hi to Joseph.
There are Catholics there, though.
A lot of Catholics, mm-hmm. Yeah. So if you're watching from Vietnam, Joseph, if you're still there, hello. And anybody else watching, say hello to us on Facebook. We'd love it. Open forum means anybody can call. You don't have to be Catholic. You don't have to be Christian. You don't even have to have a definition for what you are. You can just pick up the phone and call 888-318-7884 and ask Jimmy whatever you like. We have Matt next from Knoxville, Tennessee, watching on YouTube Live. Matt in Knoxville, your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy. Thank you for taking my call. A big fan of yours.
Thank you
very much. But So my question is, I've been reading stuff about Our Lady of Fatima, mm-hmm. and I want to know more about what does it mean, what is the meaning of consecration of Russia? Like, I just don't understand what that is.
Okay. So Our Lady of Fatima, for people who may not be familiar, is a term that's used for a series of private revelations that were reported in 1917 and subsequently by a number of children in Portugal, one of whom then grew up to be known as Sister Lucia, who lived until very recently. The other two died during the Spanish flu epidemic during World War I. And one of the things that the Virgin Mary was reported as requesting, and she's called Our Lady of Fatima because this occurred in Fatima, Portugal. And one of the things that the Virgin Mary was reported as requesting was for the Pope and the bishops of the world to consecrate Russia to her Immaculate Heart so that it would cease spreading its errors and so forth. And this was also occurring at the same time that the Russian Revolution was happening and the communists were taking over in Russia. And the request for the consecration wasn't revealed for some time. After it was revealed, there were a number of attempts by popes down through the years that were seen as partial fulfillments of this request. It wasn't completely fulfilled, though, until the 1980s, when it was done by John Paul II, and afterwards Sister Lucia herself confirmed that the consecration had been done. And it was shortly after that, within just a few years, that the Soviet Union fell apart and Russia stopped being active in the world in the same kind of way it had been during the Cold War. And that fact was not missed by John Paul II or Sister Lucia, and it was the fall of the Soviet bloc was in significant measure by many observers, including John Paul II, linked to Mary's intercession and as a fulfillment of the prophecy of Our Lady of Fatima. In terms of what the consecration itself is, this is understood as a placing of Russia, and in this case, it was actually the whole world, but with a special indication of Russia, under Mary's maternal prayers. So basically, it's a way of saying, Mary, we really would like you to pray and take under your guidance the whole world, and in particular, those people who you have indicated need this the most, in this case, the Russians, mm-hmm. Based on what all they were suffering as a result of the communist takeover of their country. Now, I need to point out that this is a matter of private revelation, so it's not a matter of Catholic faith. If you're a Catholic or a non-Catholic and you don't buy any of this, then you're not required to. The church doesn't say you're a bad person for that. But the church has looked into this, and actually I've personally looked into it, and I think I think this should be taken seriously. That's a matter of my personal opinion. I've even dedicated an episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World to all of this. So if you look up Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World and Fatima, you'll find more information on that. I have another episode that's going to be coming up in October. That's going to deal with the so-called third secret of Fatima, which is related to the consecration. But basically, the consecration itself is an act of entrusting some group or some person. A consecration in this sense is an act of entrusting some group or person to the intercession of Mary in this case, setting them aside as a special object of prayer and guidance.
Thank you, Matt, for the call. Hope that was helpful to you. Stephen's up next, listening on Guadalupe Radio in San Antonio, Texas. Stephen, your question for Jimmy.
Hello?
Hello, Stephen.
Hello.
Oh, hello. Let's keep doing this. Can you hear me, Stephen?
Yes, I can.
Okay, we can hear you. Go ahead with your question.
Okay, sir. Well, I guess my question is, how can we be sure that what we read in the Scripture, that what we've been led to believe, how can we be sure, beyond any doubt, that this is true and, in fact, the only way to salvation?
Okay. Well, in terms of how we can be sure that what we read in Scripture is true, that's the subject of apologetics. Apologetics is a study of how to defend a position, and the defense of the Christian faith, including the Christian faith's belief in the Bible, is the subject matter of Christian apologetics. It's what we do here at Catholic Answers. So, I mean, it's a very general question. How can we be sure? The answer is study apologetics. And we have lots of resources for that. Many of them are available for free at Catholic.com. That includes print resources, audio resources like this podcast, like this radio show, video resources. We also have books and DVDs and things like that. You might want to look at a particular at certain resources might be particularly helpful for you. Trent Horn, my colleague, has a book called Why We're Catholic that could be helpful to you. I have a new book that's coming out called The Bible is a Catholic Book that deals in part with how we got the Bible and some of the evidence for it being accurate. I have another book called A Daily Defense where I deal with hundreds, literally, of objections to faith and how to respond to them. So that would probably have a lot of particular things that might be of concern to you that it would have answers for, as well as positive arguments for different aspects of the faith. But I would say if you want to know how the Christian faith, including what's found in the Bible, is accurate, you need to study Christian apologetics. And we have lots of resources to help you with that.
Okay, Stephen?
Yes, sir. Well, I've studied for many years, and I'll tell you, it's just as confusing now as it's always been.
Well,
I mean that with respect. I don't mean to be disrespectful, but I've spent hours upon hours, years studying,
okay,
and I've gotten no closer to the truth or what I feel is the truth. I'm still the same person that I was when I was a child. I was the kid who put the TV, you know, the hands on the TV and prayed and believed everything you heard. I'm completely confused how I could have gone through this life with the mindset that I have, the questions that I have, and to still be completely confused. I mean, I don't understand how further study is going to help me.
Well,
I have asked God personally every day for years and years to help me, to change me. And either he doesn't want me to change and he's happy with the way I am, or there's no one listening to me. I don't know. Yeah, I don't claim to know which one it, you know, what it is. But
okay. Well, here's what I would recommend. You asked a very general question, and so I had to give a very general answer. I mean, I would suggest proceeding to look at smaller issues rather than asking a big question like, how do I know the Bible is true? I would look at smaller questions like, okay, what evidence do I have that Jesus existed? Because if I can show that there's good evidence Jesus existed, then that's one thing the Bible says that's true. And if I can establish that, I can say, okay, I have good evidence that Jesus existed and that the Bible's true to the extent it says Jesus existed. So let's move on to a new question and build on that. One reason that people sometimes have difficulty progressing in their understanding of a field is because they're not going at the subject in a piece-by-piece way. They may jump from one topic to another before getting something settled. And if you are continually jumping from one topic to another before getting that topic settled, then it's understandable that you don't make progress because you're not ever settling anything. So I would say, rather than try to approach a big question like how do I know the Bible is true or how do I know the Christian faith is true, let's start with some smaller questions that are easier to settle. And I would recommend to you my book, The Bible is a Catholic Book. It contains discussions of particular things about the Bible and the evidence for them, like the question of when particular books of the Bible were written, because it's helpful to know, well, if I can show this book was written in this time frame and it's relatively early, it's in connection with these events it's reporting, well, then that helps me understand things. For example, if I know that Paul's letter to the Romans was written in the AD 50s, if I can show that's when this was written, then that tells me something about what was being discussed in Christianity in the AD 50s. So that helps me shed light on some things. Now, that's a fairly minor one, but I would recommend looking at things like, okay, did Jesus exist? Do we have evidence for him being resurrected from the dead? And there are particular books on those subjects that can help you out, like Trent Horn's Why Be Catholic, my own book, A Daily Defense. There are quite a number of resources, but if you want to make progress, I think the way to do it is probably by taking smaller questions on issues that can be settled, where you say, okay, I've got reasonable evidence for this, so I'm going to act on the assumption that this is the case and accept it and move on to the next topic. Now, in doing that, one can always undermine progress one is making with hypotheticals. I mean, I could produce, let's say, a mountain of evidence that Jesus existed. And you could always say, well, what if all that evidence is wrong? What if there's evidence we don't have that would show that this evidence is wrong? Well, you can do that with anything. I mean, you could say, how do I know my favorite restaurant isn't poisoning me every time I go there? Well, they've never poisoned me before, but maybe that's all part of their clever plot to lure me in. And there's all this other evidence I don't have access to that shows it's really part of a clever plot to poison me in the end.
Yeah.
Well, you can always generate crazy doubts by appealing to evidence you don't have. But at a certain point, when you're looking at evidence on a particular topic, whether it's does Jesus exist or it's something else, you get to a point where you say, okay, I've seen enough evidence. I don't need to worry about this anymore. I'm going to move on. Is it 100% conclusive evidence beyond all refutation? Maybe, maybe not. But one way or another, I've seen enough that I don't need to worry about this. I can accept this. I can move on and I can make progress with a new subject.
Stephen, hang on the line. If Stephen wants, can we send him Jimmy's A Daily Defense and a copy of Trent's book, Why We're Catholic? If you want those, Stephen, we'll send them to you. And I'll also call back again, because it does sound like you have some passion for this and you would like your questions answered. So give us a call again, maybe as you move your way through those books, as more questions come up. Maybe as you try to settle basic questions like, did Jesus exist, and you run up against an obstacle, give us a call. We'd be happy to talk to you then. Right now, we have to take a break. If you'll stay on the line, Marie will get your contact number and we'll send you those books.
Catholic Answers Live. The only thing missing from today's broadcast is you. Call now with your question.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teens spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
EWTN, helping people grow in their love and understanding of God.
you know, I didn't want to hurt my child. It's not what was happening in my mind at that time. It was just all the fear and the panic. And you've got Planned Parenthood telling you it's not a baby, and it just gets all so confusing. But I'm here to speak out that the aftermath of abortion is not worth it, because I cry every day for my children.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
I got a question from Facebook for you, Jimmy. Veronica on Facebook just typed this question in. I had a baby 13 days ago. Congratulations, Veronica. And I missed one Sunday Mass as I had just gotten home the night before. Because I missed Mass, I chose not to receive communion as I wasn't sure if I would need to go to confession prior due to missing my Sunday obligation. If I cannot make it to confession before Thursday, a holy day of obligation, because Thursday this week is the right. Feast of the Assumption, should I not partake of communion again?
So I don't think I have enough information to settle the question definitively.
Okay.
But what I can tell you is that the Church understands that there are reasons why it may not be reasonable for you to go to Mass, like not feeling well because you've just had a baby and you need to rest, or even care for the child.
Yeah.
You need to stay home and care for a newborn or something like that. That's a reason to miss Mass. And in fact, care of children is actually explicitly mentioned in the Code of Canon Law as a reason it's acceptable to miss Mass. So, so I would say that if the baby is not ready to go to Mass and you need to stay home and care for the baby, or if you just need to recover after giving birth, then there's no sin in not going to Mass that day, and you would not need to go to confession.
That makes... But young moms are hard on themselves sometimes.
They can be.
Yeah. So God bless you, Veronica. Maybe share the name of the baby sometime on Facebook. Christopher in Boulder, Colorado is next. He's listening on 1060 AM. Christopher, oops, I got pushed the wrong button. Sorry. I'll get this right. Christopher, your question for Jimmy.
Hello. My question begins when a very stridently atheist college professor passed out a pamphlet regarding the Eucharistic miracle at Lanciano and mocking, although the pamphlet itself was in earnest, the fact that Jesus apparently has type AB positive blood.
Mm-hmm.
And mostly because this discussion took place in the late 90s, the first thing everybody in the room said, well, does that mean can we create a clone of Jesus? Mm-hmm. Now, the obvious answer to that is that it's scientifically impossible. There's a certain window of time during which you can extract information from a biological sample, and 2,000 years is way too long. But it occurred to me that that's kind of dodging the question, because the fact that the technology to replicate information from blood and Jesus's earthly life didn't overlap, it is just an accident of history. So I feel like there's a really interesting Christological point to be made here. I just haven't the faintest idea what it is, so I figured I would run it by somebody who seems to spend most of their time thinking about out-of-the-box questions like that.
Okay. Well, I would say a couple things here. The first one is, you know, the Church does not have a position on whether the actual DNA of Christ is present in a Eucharistic miracle. And that's something that people could have different opinions on. There is no Church teaching on that. And these miracles that also are not matters of Eucharistic miracles are not matters of Church teaching. The Church may investigate them, and in some cases it may sign off and say, okay, we have evidence that this is a genuine miracle here. But even then, it's going to be in the same kind of status as a private revelation. It's going to be something that is not required for belief. So if someone said, I don't buy a particular miracle, you know, that's been being reported today, that's okay. That Church is not saying you're doing something wrong, because these things don't bind as matters of faith. Even if a miracle is genuine, it doesn't mean that the exact DNA of Christ is being replicated in it. You could still have a miracle that doesn't involve Christ's exact DNA. So that's a second thing. If, though, a Eucharistic miracle did involve Christ's DNA, then the fact that Christ lived 2,000 years ago wouldn't matter because you'd have a fresh DNA sample. And it wouldn't, you know, you'd have the information you need in order to potentially make a clone. Also, we should be careful about saying that 2,000 years is too long to do DNA testing. Actually, there is a question about that. Egyptologists have recently been doing DNA studies on mummies from ancient Egypt. And they've reported results that have enabled us, for example, to say this mummy was the parent of this other mummy, and this mummy was the grandfather of this other mummy. We were able to identify King Tut's father apparently in this manner, and so even though it's somewhat controversial in the Egyptological community, this kind of testing is happening, and it may be possible either now or in the future to recover 2,000-year-old DNA from human remains and adequately reconstruct a person's DNA. Having said that, we obviously don't have Jesus's remains themselves because he rose from the dead and took them to heaven, but you could say, well, if the Shroud of Turin or certain other artifacts are genuine artifacts or genuine relics of Jesus, they might have DNA on them that would be recoverable. You'd have to deal with issues of contamination, for example, other people's DNA that have touched this artifact in the subsequent 2,000 years. It might not be possible to extract or identify Jesus's DNA if it survives on these artifacts. It might be too contaminated. But let's suppose you could somehow get Jesus's DNA and you knew that this is Jesus's DNA and you then decided to make a clone. What would the result be in terms of the clone, assuming you have reliable cloning technology? Well, of course, you shouldn't be cloning humans to begin with. So that's already immoral because it's not how God designed us to reproduce. So it would be wrong to make a clone of Jesus. But if you did, you would have someone who is a genetic twin of Jesus. This genetic twin would not be Jesus. It would not be the Son of God unless God chose to incarnate a second time or something, and it would not have any miraculous powers because miraculous powers go beyond what's in our DNA. And so consequently, you'd have someone who was genetically identical to Jesus, but it wouldn't be the Son of God, it wouldn't have miraculous powers, and it would be wrong to do this.
Christopher, you were referring to Jimmy when you said people who consider strange questions, right?
Absolutely, I was.
And now you got the answer you were looking for, right?
I think you said out of the box.
Out of the box. Okay. Yeah, I couldn't remember. I just slipped my mind. Thanks, Christopher. Thanks very, very much for that question. Our number 888-318-7884. It is open forum. Jimmy talked a little bit about mummies there. Jimmy and I have been recording some Focus episodes for our podcast, and they're quite popular. Jimmy talking mm-hmm. about the ancient world. We've got one up right now, Catholic Answers Focus. It's on the ancient Romans, and who were these people who played such a big part in the life of the early church and in the life of the world? So check it out at Catholic Answers Focus. So they got mummy DNA, huh?
Yeah, that's the claim.
So you could tell, like, this person is a child of this mummy, mm-hmm. and then there's that child, and then the oldest of the three would be the...
You can establish the family linkages and rebuild the family tree to a significant degree.
I was trying to get to grandmummy, but...
Oh, I see.
Nick's laughing. Thanks, Nick. Go. Was that a pity laugh? I appreciate it. Maria in South Bend, Indiana, you are up next. Your question for Jimmy.
Hello.
Hi, Maria.
So speaking of mummies, I was wondering if it was morally acceptable for a Catholic to be artificially mummified.
Oh, that's awesome.
Well, there are no specific burial procedures in terms of major types of burial that are prohibited by the Catholic Church. Mummification is a form of burial that involves the dehydration of the of the remains so that they're preserved. And that's not in principle different than preserving them through, for example, the addition of formaldehyde to impede bacterial growth. So there's no in principle reason why a person couldn't be artificially mummified. Natural mummification occurs, you know, in certain situations like in the desert or things like that. Mm-hmm. Someone dies in the desert. There's no in principle reason. There's nothing in canon law forbidding mummification as a means of preserving human remains. But you would need to follow the other standard as a Catholic. You need to follow the other standard requirements for Catholic funeral and Catholic burial. Like, we want to do this in a sacred place. You don't want to have the mummy in somebody's basement. You know, you want it properly interred in a cemetery, and preferably in a blessed plot and things like that. But as long as the other formalities are observed, there wouldn't be a prohibition on mummification in particular.
Okay, Maria?
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Man, very interesting questions today. I don't know, we're going to hit so many mummies. You're going to stay another hour, right?
Yeah, Tim? Sure.
All right, another hour. So if you're on the line, go ahead and stay on the line. Oh, we will get to your call when we come back on the other side. If you haven't dialed yet, 888-31-TRUTH is the number. It's open forum. I do not recall that we have had any non-Catholics call today. I might be forgetting one, but if you're not a Catholic, we'd love to hear from you. If you're Catholic, of course, we'd love to hear from you as well. Anybody's welcome to call. Whether your question is on the Bible, the sacraments, the popes, the saints, or any moral or religious question you might need some help with, 888-318-7884. I'll remind you again, Jimmy's brand new book, almost out, The Bible is a Catholic Book. You can pre-order it now.
This is international Catholic singer Anna Nuzzo, inviting you to join me and Father Dan Cambra of the Marian Fathers on a select international tours Divine Mercy pilgrimage to Poland and the Czech Republic. It takes place in September of 2019, and we would love for you to join us. For more information, go to my website, annanuzzo.com. Thank you, and God bless.
Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com.